I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 20th of July already. Monday at 1 o'clock means all things political. And our guest this hour is John McCormack. He's joined us fairly often. He's a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, a weekly conservative magazine and blog. He is from Wisconsin, so he knows Wisconsin politics pretty well. He grew up in Baldwin, Wisconsin. We have a lot to talk about today. You heard John McCain respond to Donald Trump's comments at the top of the news this hour. Donald Trump saying he's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, is what Donald Trump said. So how does Republicans handle? He has now been roundly condemned by the candidates for president on the Republican side. Paul Wehner in the New York Times, who's a conservative writer, said this pernicious figure on the American political landscape who traffics in racism, anti-vaxxer conspiracy theories, and malicious attacks on nearly everyone, including other Republicans, the people who have to confront and expose him are conservatives, since we're the ones who have the most to lose. We'll ask John what he thinks about that. Polls show sharp divisions after the gay marriage ruling. We'll discuss that. We'll look again at the deadly shooting at the military sites in Tennessee. Four Marines and a sailor were killed. The Iran deal, the historic nuclear accord with Iran, will it get through Congress? And what the presidential candidates, particularly Governor Scott Walker, have had to say about that. And more this hour, whatever you'd like to put on the table, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, John. Thanks for being with us again.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with Donald Trump, because he made these outrageous comments about John McCain. What do you think about this conservative writer who said conservatives really have to take him on? They have over John McCain, but not over other issues. And he goes on to say, we're the ones who have the most to lose, Republicans.
Well, I think that's good advice. You know, what I would say about Donald Trump is that he's basically a fraud. He thinks conservatives are dumb. And he himself is not a conservative. I mean, Donald Trump is a guy who, in the last decade, has supported Canadian-style single-payer health care. He has supported partial birth abortion. He himself has supported amnesty on the issue of illegal immigration. I would say what he likes to be a celebrity. He likes the fame. And so he's gone out, and since the Republican field is completely wide open nationally, he's decided that if he can say some of the most outrageous things, he's going to get the media to cover him, which they will, including the conservative media, including Fox News. And, you know, anytime you can get in the news and you can make some noise and you can bounce outside the margin of error, you're going to get into the teens in the polls, which is where he is. So I would say there is no real front runner in the party, but because there are, you know, 16 people in the party and you're splitting the vote, you know, 16 different ways, that, you know, anybody can get out there. And what he's done is he has actually exploited a problem with the party, not necessarily a problem, but that, you know, the elites of both parties, you know, sort of agree on issues like, you know, free trade and some path towards immigration reform. There may be some disagreement on what exactly that would look like. But in general, even Republicans who disagree with amnesty or what they would call what the president has done so far do support some sort of regulation or reform. And so what Trump has done is he's gone out there and he's made these wild, wild comments on issues about how he's going to, you know, stick it to China and these awful comments about immigrants. And, you know, the media attacks him, and conservatives are so used to the media being unfair to everybody on their side that if you're attacked by the media, I think that there is a certain segment that thinks, well, any Republican or someone claiming to be a Republican who's attacked by the mainstream media must be doing something right. I don't think he is doing anything right. I think he's doing a lot wrong, and I think he is those who are supporting him are being duped.
Mm-hmm. But he's obviously tapping into something, and I don't know what it is, because his poll numbers, at least prior to his comments about John McCain, have been pretty high.
Well, that's what I was saying. Yes, relatively, you know, in a field of 16 people, when you get to something like, you know, 14% or 16%, and some guys at 12%, you say that he's the front runner. I don't think Well, the real answer, who's the front runner there? It's none of the above. People don't know who they want. And at this point, national polls are basically worthless because the parties are so uncertain about who they want. The early states are going to completely shift what happens in the national polls. So the outcome of Iowa, of New Hampshire, of Nevada, South Carolina, Florida, after those five states, you're going to have the field going to narrow down to two, three, maybe four or five people. And then the national polls will matter a lot more because you're going to have multi-state primaries, you know. Super Tuesday at some point will be a big deal. But for now, you know, what the national polls show us, they don't tell us much. You know, George W. Bush, when he ran in 2000, he was a real front runner. He was at something like 65% to John McCain's 30%. Now, that's what a front runner looks like. When you're at 16% and some other guy's at 13 and then three other guys are at 10 and another four or at 8 or 9, that really shows you that nobody really knows who they want.
Right.
So, yeah, Trump's been a loudmouth, and as I said, I think he's a complete fraud and a huckster, and I think it's unfortunate that some people have played along with that and let him and not challenged the fact that he's not even a conservative. You know, he's taken liberal positions on, as I said, down the line, immigration, health care, right to life. It's, and I think that he should be called out for what he is, which is a fame seeker. I could use a worse word than that, but that's what I think he is.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it amazing when you think about people like Donald Trump, and you know, there are others who come to mind, the Kardashians, Paris Hilton, people you just do without seeing on television all the darn time, and there they are on television all the darn time.
They are, and you know, I think I don't single anyone out in particular. I think that all the media bear some blame. You know, why can't we just start ignoring this guy? I mean, I understand why we're talking about him today. He is now, because of all his media attention,
right,
because of his comments, he is technically, you know, at 14-15%, the quote-unquote front runner. So I understand why we're talking about him. I understand why they're talking about him on Fox News and all the Sunday shows. But you know what I'd love to do is I'd love to just see if for a month, could we just stop talking about Donald Trump and see what actually happens? Maybe he would drop down the polls. There's no reason we have to cover every single statement this guy says. You know, when he says something, he's a jerk. You know, he's a jerk. We don't have to go out there and give it wall-to-wall coverage, and I say that applies to Fox News and everybody in between.
All right, let's move on to the Iran nuclear deal, which has most Republican presidential candidates. They're not in favor of it. It's a historic nuclear accord with Iran. What do you think of the various, and you've written about Jeb Bush and Scott Walker's response to this accord. What do you think of Scott Walker's response? Did he bring too much military action? He talked about first day in office, he would get rid of this. Do you think he could do that? And what about the almost universal condemnation of this deal?
Well, I think that a lot in there, but I do think that it's actually Steve Hay is another Wisconsinite at the Weekly Standard. He wrote up this piece at weeklystandard.com just today, but it is on Jeb Bush and Scott Walker. It's very interesting, and I thought there was a really interesting commentary that was written today by a man named Elliot Abrams, who has served in the National Security Council. He's been an undersecretary under Presidents Reagan and Bush, and what he said is basically both men are right. You know, they're both emphasizing different aspects of this, that Walker's being more rhetorical. Obviously, you're not going to be able to end the deal completely on day one, so Bush is correct in that respect. And, you know, Bush is also correct in just that you're going to have to be, you know, laying the groundwork with allies and whatnot. But Walker's emphasizing the importance that our allies realize we're serious, and, you know, he's saying that we're going to begin to get rid of it on day one. Obviously, you can't just, you know, with a stroke of a pen undo this. You're going to have to, you know, you want your allies on there. You're going to want your team in place. So I think Bush is there. I think it's, you know, we're just starting to see a real campaign get up and running with Walker just announcing. So I don't think that this is that huge of a disagreement, but I do think it's an interesting first foray. I think it's an attempt by Bush just to sort of portray Walker as someone who's, you know, not ready for prime time. He doesn't, you know, have the chops that I do, even though Bush himself has not served in any, you know, foreign affairs capacity himself.
Mm-hmm. And yet, Governor Walker is quoted in this article that you mentioned as saying, "I believe they should be prepared to act on the very first day they take office. It's very possible, God forbid, but it's very possible that the next president could be called to take aggressive actions, including military action, on the first day in office. And I don't want a president who's not prepared to act on day one. So as far as me, as far as my position, I'm going to be prepared to be president on day one."
And I think the very important word in that statement is the word prepared, which he said about four or five times. You do have to be prepared, you know. I mean, at a transition, that can be a key time when an adversary or an enemy would like to challenge the United States. And thankfully, we haven't really had that experience so far. But they do have to be prepared. And you know, as long as that qualifier is there, I think that what he said is not objectionable.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the accord. New York Times yesterday in their editorial saying, if carried out faithfully by both sides, which is a big if, will reduce one threat that has destabilized the region, which is Iran getting a nuclear bomb. They go on to say the larger questions of human rights, competent governance, sectarian conflict, and ossified authoritarian control will remain central obstacles to development and peace in the Middle East, so that the solutions to those problems will not depend on Iran alone.
Yeah, I mean, that's and the key statement there is that if both sides uphold this agreement, you know, there's a lot in there. There's a lot that's been criticized by both Democrats and Republicans. You know, one of the biggest lines of criticism that they gave up on the idea of anytime, anywhere inspections, that we could go in and check anytime, anywhere. They had said that this was a goal. Now they backtrack, saying that this was not our side said that this is not a goal. But now, you know, Iran has 24 days from the moment we request to inspect a site. You know, the argument is obviously that if they have 24 days to clean up any site, they can, you know, scrub it clean, take away anything that they might be doing illicitly. And, you know, the best case scenario is that this sort of delays things. It gives Iran, you know, what, $140 billion that can be used for anything that even the administration has admitted could end up being used for to finance terrorism operations. So even if it does delay things a bit, which I'm not sure that it will in terms of the nuclear capability, it does seem like Iran's getting a whole lot. And we're not getting much at all. And I think that's because, you know, the president's goal throughout this entire process has been, you know, to avoid military action at any cost. And that means that he went in there with a weak negotiating hand, was basically willing to agree to any deal that would hopefully prevent an American, a Western, or Israeli strike against Iran.
At what point do you think military action by the United States might be necessary?
I don't know. I think that, I mean, the real question here is whether we think Iran is, you know, like the Soviet Union, you know, they might be bad, but if they have a nuclear weapon, you know, they're not really going to use it, are they? No one's really that crazy. And the other side of the, you know, the other point of view is, like, maybe we should actually believe them when they say death to America, when they are out there financing terrorist organizations. That do we really trust, you know, would we trust the Islamic State radicals or Al-Qaeda with a nuclear weapon? Well, no, obviously not. The question is whether or not the radical Islamists who control Iran are just as crazy, that you know, there was some sort, there was some rationality in the Cold War, and that we knew that no offense to anyone who is an atheist, but the good thing about the godless communists is that they wanted to live. They weren't seeking the apocalypse. They weren't dedicated to, you know, killing themselves and going on to this afterlife. But if our enemies are fundamentally not rational in that respect, that they mean what they say, yeah, I think that you have to act before they get a nuclear weapon, and obviously don't have the intelligence. And so that's the real question. I think if you think Iran can be contained as previous threats were, you think it's not that big of a deal if they get a nuclear weapon. If you think they mean what they say, then you have to take military action, which is a much less bad alternative than to radical Islamist terrorists getting a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this deal will pass Congress?
Well, I mean, they're going to make it an executive agreement. It definitely will not receive a majority of support, but you're not going to have, you know, you're not going to have a two-thirds majority of, you know, the House and the Senate that'll be able to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Respond, if you would, to Maureen Dowd's column yesterday. She said that the president is gambling that he won't hurt his party, and that in 10 years, Iran will be a better member of the international community. And then she goes on to really criticize the George W. Bush administration. He can't do worse as an oracle of the Middle East than the conservative warmongers who ravaged the region.
Well, to respond to that, I would say that we've, you know, President Obama's now been president for 6 years, going into his, what, his seventh year. And we've been trying, you know, this alternative, withdraw, you know, pull out, pull back, and, you know, maybe we're the problem, maybe we're the ones stirring up this hornet's nest. And what we've seen happen in Iraq is that things have managed to deteriorate. They've deteriorated, throughout the Middle East and places where we weren't, like Egypt, obviously places where we were, again, like Libya, so the same criticism against Bush could apply to the goings-on in Libya. But, in Yemen, the Islamist terrorism is not going to go away simply because we retreat. And so the question is which is better? I mean, neither alternative is great. Neither is pleasant. I mean, the idea of involvement or isolationism and letting, the radical Islamic state develop in Iraq and Syria, but that's where we are. So I think that, I think we've seen the President Obama's plan for the last 6 years, and that has not succeeded.
Another deadly shooting at the military sites in Tennessee last week. 4 Marines and a sailor were killed. It would appear that terrorism is at play here. Do you expect to see more of this kind of action in the United States, and how do we counter that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, it's very hard to counter. I mean, I think that we could step up our intelligence efforts. I mean, this was a man who had taken multiple trips to the Middle East. We don't know exactly what we knew about him in advance. And the one practical thing could be that, I mean, law enforcement agents, police officers, are licensed to carry weapons. I think that our military recruiters should be able to protect themselves. And it's well known that they are not allowed to carry weapons, that they are essentially sitting ducks. And so I do think that that is one practical thing in this particular issue where we've had at Fort Hood, Texas, where 14 people were killed in 2009. No one was armed in that mess hall when Major Nidal Hassan began opening fire. No one was armed in Chattanooga when this young man, Mr. Abdulaziz, opened fire on them. So I do think that they should be allowed to protect themselves.
But what about the other issue of ISIS being, for whatever reason, it's impossible to understand, attractive to somebody who's living a somewhat normal life in Tennessee? What do you do about that?
That's a great question. I don't know if there's an easy answer. I think that we do have to. This does force us to confront the fact that the idea that everyone who is attracted to ISIS is somehow just unemployed and just if they had a job, they wouldn't turn to this radical Islamic terrorism. That's not true. Obviously, we know that Mohammed Atta, one of the 9/11 hijackers, came from a very wealthy family, a very educated family. It's ultimately an ideology, and maybe it's an ideology that people turn to when they don't find meaning in anything else, when they turn against ideas like freedom. And it's ultimately an ideological struggle, and some people are going to find this radical interpretation of Islam to be appealing and believe that to be true, and therefore they're going to go out and act upon various commandments to kill infidels wherever they find them.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, John, and we'll do so in a moment. This is All Things Political, which you always hear on Mondays, and John McCormick is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the Iran deal. We're talking about how Republican candidates stepped up to criticize Donald Trump. We're talking about why we keep talking about Donald Trump. John is a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, a conservative magazine and blog, and he is from Wisconsin. He's been following Governor Scott Walker pretty closely, so we will be looking at the governor's campaign for the presidency and some of his comments, and we'll look at the polls now showing sharp divisions after the gay marriage ruling. We'll spend more time on that and more time on each of the candidates. Bernie Sanders drawing 11,000 people in Phoenix, wasn't it? Everybody says he doesn't have a chance for the nomination, but he is drawing huge crowds. So we will look at the reason for that. Here's how you reach us. We'd like to hear from you today. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for John McCormack. 800-486-8655 is the number, and we start with Steve in Danbury. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Say, I wonder if your guest hears the irony, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when he's responding to the New York Times editorial about the Iran nuke deal, he says, yes, it will be a good agreement if both sides uphold it, the implication being that we probably can't trust the Iranians. Just a couple minutes after he got done talking about Scott Walker's plan to not uphold the deal if he becomes president. Seems like there's a little bit of an internal contradiction there.
John.
Well, I was saying that if you believe that the Iranians are not going to uphold it, that they're going to pursue a nuclear weapon, that they need to be stopped, then yes, it makes sense to undo it.
We're going to talk about this in great length tomorrow during this hour of the show. We'll look at the deal. Do you have a follow-up, Steve?
Well, yeah, he didn't really respond to what I said, I guess. He basically is saying, he's talking about if the Iranians don't uphold it, then we should have a plan to not uphold it or something like that. But
saying the Iranians can't be trusted to uphold it. And that they,
yeah,
they,
but we can't apparently either. We have presidential candidates out on the stump saying they won't uphold the deal.
Yeah, my point is that the Iranians are dedicated to killing as many Americans and Westerners as possible, and that they can't be trusted with a nuclear weapon, and that this deal won't stop them from getting a nuclear weapon. So there's just a difference of opinion there.
But what if they do? What if they do uphold their end of the deal?
If they do uphold their end of the deal, that means that they would get a nuclear weapon in 10 years instead of in a couple of years, and they would have $140 billion to finance terrorism operations. Conventional weapons ban lifted. We don't get our hostages back, our American prisoners over there. I just don't think I don't think that the delay is really as great of a benefit to us as to Iran, and nor do I believe they're actually going to put themselves in a position where they are that far delayed.
So it makes sense for Republican candidates then, if the deal, and it looks like it will pass Congress, at least at this point in time, if indeed it does become a deal, how should Republican candidates campaign on this deal? That they would try to undo the deal once they became president, or what would be most beneficial, John?
It won't pass Congress. I mean, it won't be blocked by Congress, but those are two very different things. You're not going to get a majority
right
in either house. But from a political perspective, yeah, I think that the difference between Walker and Bush is interesting right now, where they're both, Walker's trying to prove how tough he is by saying he'll undo it on day one, and Bush is trying to show that he is the adult in the room and pointing out the complexities and actually taking that down right now. But, I think the Republican Party is completely unified. Even Rand Paul, who is known for being very dovish, who has opposed the Iraq war, unlike Hillary Clinton, even he denounced this deal. So I don't think there's any, not a single candidate has found any upside to supporting this deal.
Let's go. Steve, thank you for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
I want to talk about the radicalization of people in this country for whatever reason. And let me state, we are censored here in the United States. We don't see what our drone bombing daily is doing around the world in countries we have not declared war on. Yemen, you name it, in the Middle East, we're doing these drone bombings. And if we saw pictures of children dead, grandmothers dead, families going to wedding parties, them being bombed from the air, from seemingly nowhere, it's like if we can't see what we're doing to antagonize these people, then let's stop pretending that this is just happening out of the clear blue sky, that for whatever reason this guy started shooting up the police barracks in Chattanooga. It's obvious what is making these people angry. It's the one-sided thing that Mr. Obama has done way more than Bush did. It's the drone bombings. We could stop that tomorrow.
John.
Well, I think that the idea that we should blame ourselves for this is mistaken. We are there for, let's go back to the beginning.
you know, why are we involved overseas? Why are we engaged in this war on terrorism over there? We, you know, Osama bin Laden's declaration of war against the West involved that he was very angry that we had troops in Saudi Arabia. Why did we have troops in Saudi Arabia? It was to stop a secular dictator from invading the Muslim Holy Land of Saudi Arabia to liberate Kuwait, a Muslim country. So that's the reason he was there. We've got all these terrorists who are there in Yemen, in Al-Qaeda, throughout the Middle East. And whether we bomb them or not, they're coming after us, I think. If we don't bomb them, they're going to plot and they're going to kill us. And do some people get radicalized because of this? Sure. But a lot of them just get radicalized and are plotting, and they're not going to stop. If we were to stop bombing terrorists, Al-Qaeda terrorists, ISIS terrorists tomorrow, I don't think that people are just going to lay down their arms. They're just going to have more time to plan, to plot, and to kill Americans and other Westerners.
Do you think we made a mistake and perhaps created more turmoil in the region by invading Iraq, John, or not?
In 2003?
Yes.
Well,
you know,
it's both go-arounds. It's how to do counterfactual. Well, yeah, I mean, you want to really go back to make a real. I mean, it's just so hard with these counterfactuals. I mean, let's say you go back and we never invaded Iraq back in 1991 when we had the entire world on our side to liberate a country that had been invaded after, you know, the lesson of World War II is we weren't going to allow other countries just to invade other countries and to not pay a price for it. So if we hadn't been involved there ever, would we be dealing with, you know, the problem of Islamist terrorism right now? I don't know. You know, the idea of Saddam, a dictator who had taken over not only Kuwait, but, you know, the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and perhaps conquered Iran someday, that presents all sorts of different problems. I mean, there's a real debate here about, you know, whether or not our involvement has brought this upon ourselves. I think obviously you can't go back in time, and the efforts to withdraw over the past 6 years, I believe, have been unsuccessful in making things better.
Mm-hmm. We'll go back to phone calls in a moment. Ray, thank you for yours. Our number is 800-486-8655. I'm interested in how the Republicans particularly will handle the issue of gay marriage. The Associated Press poll is interesting recently, showing that there are very sharp divisions after the gay marriage ruling, that support for gay unions might be down slightly from earlier this year. 47% of people saying that local officials with religious objections should be required to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples, 47% saying yes, 49% saying no, 59% saying wedding-related businesses with religious objections should be allowed to refuse service to same-sex couples, 46% said businesses more generally should be allowed to refuse service to same-sex couples. Governor Scott Walker got himself in a bit of trouble by what he had to say about the Scout leadership and whether or not to allow people who are gay to be leaders of Scouts, and then he changed his thoughts on that. How is this issue, how much will it be played in the campaign for Republicans? There obviously is a large segment of the American population that has a problem with this ruling. How does it play out politically?
Well, I think that the real issue right now is this issue of sort of where religious liberty would collide with gay marriage or right to or gay rights in general. You know, Wisconsin's had a gay rights law since 1982. I grew up in Wisconsin from 1985 to 2003. Never heard of any problems with it. But when you start taking these laws and you turn them from a shield to protect people who are gay into a sword to attack people who don't feel they can, in good conscience, you know, be a wedding singer or a photographer or a baker or a florist working at a gay wedding, and basically punish them. That's a real problem. That's what started to happen in states like Oregon, where a couple of bakers, they were fined $135,000 for declining to work at a same-sex wedding, even before gay marriage was legal over there. This has happened in New Mexico, where there was a photographer who said you know, she didn't feel that she could participate, that she would in some way be not living up to her religious beliefs, and you can disagree with her. I don't think that, you know, there's a wide variety of opinion whether or not you support same-sex marriage, whether or not it's okay to work there. I'm sure there are some people who oppose gay marriage and could in good conscience go there. The idea of religious liberty is that we leave each person to their own beliefs. You know, the real issue is obviously, I think, in these, you know, public accommodation laws is, you know, something like Jim Crow in the South, where you had a real pervasive, widespread, horrific practice of denying people services at hotels, restaurants, really essential things. And you had to have the government come in and step in there. And right now, I would say when the issue is more of these, you know, kind of close calls with people who are, for the most part, just, you know, trying to act in accordance with their own religious beliefs, I don't think that that's... That's so objectionable. I think that those people do need to be protected, and moreover, things like religious schools should have the freedom to continue to teach whatever religious beliefs that they have.
Yes, but didn't some people believe that intermarriage was against their religious beliefs, and we lived through horrendous years in religions on various sides of issues. Wasn't it okay to discriminate because of religious beliefs when it came to some issues concerning race in this country? What's the difference?
Well, no, it wasn't. I mean, the difference is, again, I said in the Jim Crow side. Yes, if we had a situation comparable to the treatment of blacks in the South under Jim Crow, under segregation, if that was happening in modern America to any group, including gay Americans, I would fully support gay rights laws. But I think that that's not happening, and so I would be more concerned about the government using those laws to discriminate against religious dissenters at this point. But yeah, I think that when a group is just widespread discrimination, you can't eat here, you can't serve here. 88% of Fortune 500 companies already have formal policies saying that we will not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. You know, most people have a de facto policy of that. I mean, Rick Santorum, who is viewed as, you know, sort of this boogeyman, this monster who is against gay rights, he employed one of his top staffers was openly gay, and he said, "We can disagree on this issue. That's okay." I think that's you know, if gay people were being discriminated against on a widespread basis, I think that'd be one thing. But right now, the real question is whether or not religious schools are going to start to, you know, lose their tax status, lose their charitable tax status, lose their accreditation someday, even, I think, is a real concern. And so I'm more concerned about their religious liberty being protected right here, and I don't see a widespread discrimination being necessary to trample on free association rights as well as religious liberty rights.
Yeah, but there are the people in the gay community, those who wish that same-sex marriage had been not been issued, number one, are still very concerned about discrimination in housing, discrimination in jobs, and all kinds of discrimination that they hope will be written into federal law so that you can't discriminate on the basis of your sexual persuasion. Why is it that the Republicans are choosing to focus on religious liberty instead of non-discrimination against anybody?
Well, I mean, who's being discriminated against here? Is it the people who have the religious beliefs?
People who are gay. People who are gay are being discriminated against.
I mean, on where and what in what capacity? I mean, I think that's the real
People losing their jobs, people losing their housing.
How many people in the last 5 years have lost their job because they're gay or their housing?
I don't have a number, but I certainly know that it's fairly widespread from talking to people.
Fairly widespread?
Yes.
I just think that's. I just think.
But you're not answering my question. Why not?
No. I mean, well, it's important. I mean, if the number of people who have lost a job simply because they're gay is six in a country of 300 million, then you have to weigh that against the question of whether or not we're going to go in and say to a religious school, to a Christian school, that if you continue to Christian schools, a number of Christian schools say you need to uphold the teachings of our faith to have a job in our Christian school. This is a private school, and that includes not beliefs about marriage and, you know, not just simply about gay sexual relations, but any sort of relations outside of marriage between a man and a woman. And if the government's going to start coming in there and taking away their accreditation, saying that you essentially can't be a school, that you will not be accredited, means you're not a real school. You know, when you graduate from that school, your degree is worth nothing. You don't go on to college. You don't. You can't participate in American economic life. You know, you can maybe go, you know, milk cows or grow some potatoes in a field, but you certainly can't get a job. I think that's where this is heading. You know, I think that the real question to me is, I think that there could be something worked out. I could totally imagine supporting a law, you know, banning discrimination against people who are gay, if there were acceptable, you know, carve outs and protections for religious schools, you know, for people in certain, you know, if imagine in an elementary school where a teacher is going through a transition to be transgender. This is a real issue that's happened in a very small handful of places. Like I said, you know, a small number of places, but might happen more in the future. And they're being told that you can't, you know, if a teacher goes home on one week and comes back the next week as the opposite gender, you know, that might be in some school districts, they might think that's great and should be celebrated. In other school districts, the parents might say, hey, I don't think this is appropriate for my child to be, you know, subjected to these sorts of discussions. And so I don't know that we need a federal law regulating that.
Well, I don't want to belabor this issue, except that it does seem to me to be an issue in the Republican presidential campaign right now. And the governor of Wisconsin, Governor Walker, did say last week when asked to comment on the Boy Scout leadership decision, he had to backtrack what he said, that he talked about he liked the way that it was, and he talked about protecting our children, and the inference was protecting our children from people who are gay. Some saw that as a really objectionable statement. I'm wondering politically what that does for him and what you thought about that particular statement at a time when, I mean, obviously it takes a long time in the country for things to change, but the country does seem to be going in a different direction.
That particular statement, yeah, that's what he said, and I think that most people inferred that that's what he meant as well. He backtracked and said that he was saying he was protecting the scouts from the sort of the political back and forth and debate. I'm not sure a lot of people believe that. But, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, private organizations that we should still believe in free association. You know, I don't think that a religious wedding singer, a Christian wedding singer, who her business is to sing at weddings, should lose her job, should be fined by the government, and have her livelihood taken away because she doesn't believe she can sing religious songs at a same-sex ceremony. I don't think that a gay American should lose her job because she doesn't want to sing at a church where they don't believe in gay marriage. I don't think that an atheist should have to sing at a religious ceremony. I don't think that, you know, there's all sorts of freedom of association that we respect in this country that, you know, I don't think that someone who is, you know, should have to bake a wedding cake with a Confederate flag on it or whatever, or a cross on it if you're an atheist and you don't want to do that. You know, I think we're taking these little things and we're just blowing them completely out of proportion. You know, we're searching for you know, demons to destroy when they don't really exist. I think if we all just sort of tried to be polite and be respectful and just let people, you know, it was supposed to be live and let live. You know, how is this going to affect you? And now we're finding out that, well, oh, if you're, you know, a religious baker and you don't think you can work at same-sex weddings, we're going to fine you $135,000 and essentially shut you down.
But, John, what about a presidential candidate saying that the Boy Scouts' ban on gay leaders protected children and advanced Scout values? What does that say?
Well, it protected them from a discussion about homosexuality at a very young age. Scouts are very young, and some parents, I think a lot of parents would say that there are age-appropriate discussions about sexuality, whether you think that homosexuality is okay or it's not okay. I do think that it is an issue where parents are, you know, some parents might think it's an okay conversation at age 13. Other parents might think it's a discussion at age 5 or 6. And if a scout leader is talking about, a gay scout leader is talking about his husband, that obviously raises these questions that kids are going to, you know, be talking about. And so I think that, again, private organizations, we're not talking about, you know, any government benefits or anything. We're talking about free people and a free association in civil society coming together, and they've now changed their policy, and they're free to do that. And I think that people should, you know, continue to be free to form private organizations and associate as they please.
We'll go to more phone calls in a moment. John McCormack is our guest for this hour of All Things Political. He's a senior writer at the Weekly Standard, and we have No lines open right now, but eventually there will be some. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@WPR.org, Facebook page The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John McCormack is with us now for all things political, and let's go next to Lori in Madison. Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead.
Prepared. Thanks. I appreciate the show. And I really am tempted to go into Iraq and Afghanistan and the policy that we had there and the fact that it is a disaster, and we did create, by putting American soldiers there, we created terrorist targets instantly. But I'll go to the point. You were talking about poll numbers with respect to Trump. And I wanted to point out that at the present time, in the state of Texas, over half the population of Texas, if the polling is to be believed, think that the military operations being conducted in that state and in other southern states are a plot by the Obama administration to impose martial law and confiscate their firearms. And you know, these kinds of beliefs, or the ability to believe this kind of thing, I would suggest to you, doesn't come from you just out of the blue. But if you look at Fox News, which has reports, for example, about this and that, and the way that they suggested there were the non-Muslim zones in Birmingham, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you know, people tend to react with fear.
John.
I don't think that, I have not paid any close attention, but I do not think that Fox News has been promoting any particular conspiracy theory about Texans being subjected to a military exercise by the Obama administration. There was a great deal of truth to the idea that there are certain areas in European capitals where police tread lightly because of fear of backlash from, you know, primarily youths who are radical Muslims. Whether they got some of the particulars wrong, I didn't look into that too closely, but I have read good detailed reporting on that problem, and it is a problem. So those two specific points, I do think that, I mean, journalists in general, we all have an obligation to get the facts right, to not, you know, to tell the truth. The most important thing is to just get the, you know, we can always disagree on our opinions, but we should, you know, go to great lengths to disprove conspiracy theories. I don't know. I mean, I was just thinking in terms of, you know, elections. I did my best to, you know, I reported closely. There were a lot of conspiracy theories on the recount between Al Franken and Norm Coleman in 2008, and a lot of the stuff in the conservative press wasn't true, and I said I didn't find anything to back it up. So I do think that we all have an obligation to tell the truth and do to the best of our abilities.
Lori, thanks for the call. Jean in Galesville, hi.
Hello. I wanted to comment on the guest's suggestion that, along with some of the other governors that have spoken up, that the answer to problems like Chattanooga is to arm all the military men at these recruitment stations. And to me, in most cases, we're dealing with people that are depressed, mentally ill. I don't think the answer is more guns. I think the answer is a better treatment ahead of time on figuring out people that have mental illness, dealing with them before they reach this crisis point. And that an approach from that angle might be more humanitarian in the long run and might take a little bit of the edge out of the radical nature of the whole situation.
Well, Gene, if indeed this person turns out to be a member of ISIS and did this on behalf of ISIS, how in the world would you deal with that?
Well, I do think that I work in a school, and we've taken precautions since Sandy Hook of protecting the schools by having a system where you have to check in with the secretary. The doors are locked. There's a little more security at the front door. Mm-hmm. And I think that's maybe in order at these recruitment centers. It sounds like this guy was able to just walk in, walk down the hall, or not even walk down the hall, just open up and start blasting.
Mm. John, what do you think?
A lot in there, but I do think that in terms of, you know, the mental illness issue, I do think that we in America need to, and I don't think this is necessarily where this guy suffered from some depression. We don't know at this point, but we do know that in many other of these mass shootings that are usually non-terrorism related, not or at least not related to, you know, some sort of radical Islamic terrorism connections overseas, schizophrenia, things like that are an issue. And so I do think that we need to reevaluate our laws in a way to make it easier for families to involuntarily commit loved ones, to help them get treatment. That's an issue. But in terms of this specific case, I do think that there's no reason why our military men and women, who are just as responsible as our law enforcement men and women, shouldn't be able to protect themselves with sidearms.
Gene, thank you. Let's go to Louis in Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Hello. I would make this comment that on the subject of people using religious beliefs to excuse their prejudices against gays and a lot of other things are a phony issue, because the fact is we are not a particularly religious country. Maybe a couple of percent of us are religious and the rest are secular or don't care, and I can back that up with a solid authority.
Joan.
I do think that a lot of the religious dissenters are a minority in this country. You know, I think that you would see even a lot of Orthodox Christians, real believers, who would be able to, you know, work in certain capacities. The hypothetical I like to deal with, you know, is whether or not, you know, it gets to a real free speech, a real clear-cut free speech issue, real clear-cut religious freedom issue, is can a Catholic who is a wedding singer be compelled to sing at a same-sex wedding, be compelled to sing songs, religious songs, the Ave Maria, even though that runs directly contrary to her religious beliefs. The reason I can name most of the cases that are out there off the top of my head, because there aren't that many cases. You know, most businesses don't want to lose the business. They don't want to face these protests, these boycotts, which you can do. I mean, I would recommend against it, but I'm not saying it's always going to be legal to boycott, you know, a store or a business if they don't, you know, do this. That's why it doesn't happen on a widespread basis. You know, if there were hotels or restaurants in this country that simply said, you know, we don't serve gays here, which is what happened in the South to black people on a widespread basis throughout multiple states, you know, that's a completely different scenario here. And what we're talking about is really, it's a small number of religious dissenters and a small number of cases where, you know, there's a case in Washington State where a florist served a gay couple for years and years. They had a great relationship. And when it came time for the same-sex wedding, she said, you know what, I don't think I can do this in good conscience to be there on your wedding day to do this. I love you very much, but here are three other people who can help you. And now she's being sued. And that's where this thing is heading. And those are the real issues. Maybe you think that's just so horrendous that these people should be punished. Maybe you think we should make space in this country for those people as well as people who are gay.
Well, if you have a business and you're serving everybody, you serve people who are gay. You can't. I don't quite get that. So they're having a wedding and you're doing the flowers for it. And if you're in a business doing flowers, it's okay to discriminate because the people you're getting the flowers for happen to be same sex?
Well, there are certain people. I'm not saying I believe this. I'm saying, for me, where would the line draw? It'd be something like singing religious songs. But other people feel that their artistry is represented in their photography or the messages that they write on wedding cakes or whatever. And for other, in their good conscience, they can't do that. For instance, I would say that, I mean, would a gay baker have to bake a cake for a viciously anti-gay wedding if you know, if it was the Fred Phelps, you know, those wacko Westboro Baptists, should gay bakers be required to bake a wedding cake or work at a wedding like that? I'm not in any way comparing people who are gay to the bigots like Westboro Baptist, but I just think that in general we should respect freedom of association, freedom of religion, and that, you know, the government only needs to step in when there is a big problem, and we don't have a big problem with this in this country.
Thank you, John, very much for being with us. John McCormack, our guest for All Things Political. We thank him very much for being with us, and thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour and for on-air production as well here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for your calls. We have news coming up, and we'll return and talk Little League Baseball.